Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The recent establishment of a coalition government in Austria that includes the nation's extreme right Freedom Party has brought about a swift and negative response from the European Union and the United States. In today's show, we will be talking to an expert on Austrian history about that coalition and why it has raised such concern. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week, in 1614, the Algonquin woman Pocahontas married John Rolfe. In sharp contrast to what has been written in most books and songs about her true love for Rolfe, Pocahontas, also credited with saving the life of Captain John Smith, married the Virginian largely for diplomatic reasons. Pocahontas joined Rolfe in holy matrimony, taking part in a Christian ceremony and accepting the name Lady Rebecca, while she was being held prisoner, relieving some of the tensions that had been building between the Virginians and her people. Soon after her marriage, Pocahontas traveled with her husband to England to further her diplomatic efforts. She died before she could return to her native land and was buried in the graveyard of the Church of St. George at Kent in England. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, nearly 100 years after he was brutally killed by a white lynch mob, Tennessean Ed Johnson, a black man accused of raping a white woman in 1906, was recently cleared of any wrongdoing. In 1906, a local white woman of Chattanooga was raped. Shortly after reporting the incident to the town sheriff, local authorities charged Johnson with the crime, and he was convicted. Johnson appealed the decision, but when the Supreme Court ordered a stay of execution, a group of white townspeople dragged him from his cell, paraded him through the streets, and hanged and shot him. You're listening to Talking History. On February 4th, a new coalition government took office in Austria. It includes the nation's extreme right Freedom Party, which is closely associated with the controversial Austrian politician Jörg Haider. In a rare example of widespread and unified protest against such internal matters, the European Union took immediate steps to sanction and isolate Austria, a member nation. The United States quickly followed suit. Haider has since resigned as official head of the Freedom Party, but the party remains in office. As our guest today will explain, the controversy has deep historical roots. He is Anson Robbenbach, professor of history and director of the program in European Cultural Studies at Princeton University. Welcome, Professor Robbenbach.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Let me ask you to first briefly summarize for us, if you will, what's happened in Austria to cause such an international commotion.
Well, as you mentioned, after 50 relatively, more than 50 relatively peaceable years in Austria, far-right extremist party has been included, I should be very precise about this, has been included in a coalition government, not for the first time, actually, in Austrian history, but in an important way for the first time since World War. Since the end of World War II.
When you say they're included, are they included in a majority capacity or minority?
No, they're a minority. They're a minority in a coalition government with the Majority People's Party, party under the leadership of a man named Wolfgang Schüssel.
So why is the European Union so upset with all of this?
Well, I think the European Union's reaction, a very profound and overwhelmingly consensual reaction, I might add, was not because this government was in any way undemocratically elected. On the contrary, precisely because it was democratically elected, it posed a very serious danger for Europe. The protest of the European Union was a moral protest against the inclusion of a far-right party in a center-far-right coalition. This is really an anomaly in Europe. Since 1945, European political leaders, especially conservatives, have had a virtual taboo on such coalitions. Conservatives barred entry into legitimate politics of the extreme right because of the memory of the interwar period, when many authoritarian and fascist parties came to power legally by being included in precisely such center-far-right coalitions, the most famous one being the coalition of Hitler and the Catholic Party of von Papen in 1933, which brought Hitler to power in Germany.
Before I take you back in history, let me just follow up on that a bit. Why do you think they violated that taboo to which you just referred?
Why did the Austrians violate
right.
that taboo?
Right.
Well, very simply because the politics of post-war Austria, which really included 50 years of a virtual coalition government and more than 30 years of government by a majority Social Democratic Party, had literally become bankrupt. The parties could not form, the two major parties, the People's Party could not, and the Socialist Party could not form a coalition. In fact, the other reason is that Haider, I think this is another reason for the European Union's extreme reaction, is that Haider's party has an unprecedented vote and is one of the most successful, is the most successful far-right party in Europe.
Okay.
Haider received, in the October elections, the Freedom Party received 27% of the vote, whereas most far-right parties in Europe get about, at the most, 15% of the vote and generally average around 5% of the vote and in most cases less.
Is there a fear of spillover here or a momentum for the right?
I think there is a fear that that Haider will become a model for other far-right parties to change their political strategy to become more acceptable, to become more modern as Haider is, and to be seductive enough to conservative parties to be included in such coalitions. Chancellor Schroeder in Germany referred to the Haiderization of Europe, and I think that sums up the threat that the European Union was reacting to.
Okay, I may want to return to that, but in your op-ed you wrote recently for the LA Times, you suggested that one answer for all of this lies in Austria's sort of Nazi years, taking us back really to the end of World War I. Explain that for us, if you will.
Well, I think that's very much the case. I think that a man like Haider, and I should add, I'd just like to add that Haider is not, as he's often been described, a neo-fascist or a neo-Nazi. It would be much too simple to describe him in this way. In many respects, he's a free market politician who's also against the European Union. That's a paradox, and he's full of paradoxes. He's for the welfare state, but he's against what his party has called the over-foreignization of Austria. In other words, the welfare state is for Austrians, not for foreigners. And he has made on occasion in the past pro-Nazi statements, but he's issued as many or more mea culpas for those statements. So he's very difficult to pin down, very slippery character. And I think that also is part of his appeal and his success.
Okay.
But to come back to your question about the Nazi years, I think Austria has had a very odd post-war history. In many ways, unlike Germany, it has not had to face its Nazi past. In fact, after 1945, Austria was welcomed into the community of European nations as the first country to be occupied by the Nazis. That was, in fact, the declaration of the Allies issued in Moscow in 1943, to the effect that Austria was the first victim of Nazi aggression. And that, of course, created what could, I think, reasonably called the myth of post-war Austria, that Austrians had a national consciousness before 1938, that most Austrians were anti-Nazi, that most Austrians suffered under the Nazis. None of that, of course, is true. The Anschluss with Germany in March 1938 was welcome. There was tremendous pro-Hitler sentiment in Austria. A million people greeted Hitler's first speech on the Heldenplatz in Vienna. Austria profited from Nazification. It profited from the Aryanization of Jewish property. Many Austrians personally profited from that. It was a great deal of social mobility for Austrians under the Nazis. And, of course, Nazified Austria was deeply committed in the crimes of the Nazis. After the war, all of that was forgotten. And it was forgotten in part for good reasons. Austria in the First Republic, that is from 1918 to 1938, this is pre-Nazi Austria, was a very violent and contentious place. The political parties, the Christian Social Party, which was in many ways the forerunner of today's People's Party, and the Socialist Party, were armed camps. They had private armies, each of which was larger than the Austrian National Army. There were almost daily street battles. The Republic was a place of a kind of permanent civil war, latent civil war, that erupted in a real civil war in February 1934. The Socialists were banned. Many of them went into exile. And then from 1934 to 1938, the Nazi Party and the Christian Social Party also competed for control of Austria. The Austrian dictator Engelbert Dollfuss, who was a Christian social dictator, he came from a small party actually, but he was an Austrian fascist, as he's often referred to, was assassinated by the Nazis, who tried to take power in a coup d'etat in July 1934. Interestingly enough, by the way, just a parenthesis. Jörg Haider's father was one of the participants in that putsch attempt. He was a part of a military force that was poised to take over Austria after the success of the assassination attempt. Of course, that failed, and he was sent into exile. But this this history goes a long way, I think, towards explaining Jörg Haider's sentimental feelings about some of these former Nazis in Austria.
So 2 points follow up on that. You're suggesting, and I think this might be news to some, then that the far right was more of a threat during the 30s than was the communist left.
Oh, I think that's very true in Austria. I think that the problem with Austrian politics is that it's very complicated and that there were two far rights. There was a Christian social far right, and there was a Nazi far right, and they were at loggerheads with each other. These parties were literally competing for control of Austria. So in many ways, the Nazification of Austria in 1938 solved the problem of the internal civil war, the multi-party civil war that existed from 1918 to 1945. I should also add that after World War I, most Austrians did not feel like they belonged to a country called Austria. The general feeling was that the country, the Austria, did not have the capacity to survive. Most Austrians, German-speaking Austrians, felt that they belonged to Germany. And in fact, all of the parties, not just the parties of the right, but the parties of the left and the parties of the center as well, favored an Anschluss, an annexation, by Germany in 1918. This was prevented and precluded by the post-war diplomatic settlements, which obviously did not want to strengthen Germany by adding Austrian territory to Germany. The purpose of the Versailles Agreement, as is well known, and the other agreements, was to weaken Germany. So Austria was denied the privilege of annexation. Many Austrians felt that this was a very dark period in Austrian history. In any case, there was no real national consciousness in Austria before World War II. It was only after World War II that Austrians had to, in effect, invent a tradition of national consciousness and national identity. And that is another reason that the past was swept under the rug. After 1945, Austria was occupied by all four powers. In fact, it was occupied by the Russians, the Americans, the French, and the British until 1955. The famous film The Third Man really gives you a feeling for how that occupation worked. And Austrians wanted to make sure that they appeared to be a nationally oriented, peaceful, democratic people so that they could, in effect, win their independence, which they did in 1955, a very anomalous situation in the history of Europe, I might add. They were the only country in Europe from which the Soviets withdrew in 1955 as a gesture of Khrushchev towards the West, and Austria became independent in the state treaty of 1955. So there were many reasons to sweep the past under the rug, to make sure that the enmity between the old armed parties didn't flare up again, that Austrians appeared to be democratic and capable of cooperation, and they in fact were. The new republic, the second republic that came about after 1955, was in effect a very stable government. In fact, it was an excessively stable government.
Okay. Let me just follow up then so you can tie this correctly in. We only have a couple minutes left. You said in your op-ed that the greatest appeal that Haider seems to have had is to voters under 30. Now, how do they play into this sort of role?
Well, I think that's this is very much consistent with what I've said up to now. The new political system that emerged in Austria after 1955 was a system of a division of power between the two major parties. What that meant, in effect, was that the two parties controlled every political appointment, every civil service appointment, and most municipal appointments. To be a fireman or a sanitation worker or a teacher or even a college professor, you had to belong to one of the parties. And these parties apportioned and distributed those jobs. It was the parties, the People's Party and the Socialist Party, had a locked grip on Austrian society. And young people today, confronted with that system, feel that it's, first of all, in many ways, not a terribly democratic system, that it's certainly not a meritocratic system, and it's certainly not a system with a lot of freedom. So young people see Haider's party in many ways as the breaking up of the monopoly of power held by the two major parties, the People's Party and the Socialist Party, since the end of World War II.
Okay, very briefly, Austrians see this as an internal matter, yet the EU is bringing pressure upon them. I know you're an historian, not a soothsayer, but what's going to happen, do you think?
Well, it's very interesting. I think that first of all, I should say that most Austrians, Haider gets 27% of the vote, but 70% of Austrians have said in polls that they did not favor a government with the Freedom Party. The demonstrations over the last weekend in Vienna, which mobilized some 300,000 people against the government, show that many, many people are willing to take to the streets against new constellation in Austrian politics. My feeling is that this is a party, that this is a government, I should say, this is a government that is very much under pressure, a government that is under the watchful eye not only of Austrians but of Europe. Now, of course, there are many Austrians, I suppose, and the polls show this, who feel that the EU has overreacted, that Austria is becoming isolated, and that has, in some areas, enhanced Haider's popularity. My general feeling is that this government will not last long and that there will be new elections. And that, I think, is a very, it's very difficult to say what will happen, but certainly if the Freedom Party becomes the majority party in Austria, that would be a very, very pessimistic outcome for the situation. My hope is that the Green Party, which seems to be gaining support since the government was formed, and the Socialist Party will be able to form a coalition and put both the People's Party and the Freedom Party out of office. But I think that will take time. This is a process that will take many months, if not years.
Right. Well, we'll all be keeping an eye on it and maybe invite you back some time to either take credit for the correct prediction or explain why you were wrong. Thank you for joining us.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Anton Robbenbach, professor of history and director of the program in European Cultural Studies at Princeton University. And you are listening to Talking History. Thank you.
immigration levels are as high as they've ever been in the United States, and so too are calls for immigration reform. This is nothing new, of course, as we saw much the same response a century ago when immigration levels were similarly high, the welcoming arms of the recently erected Statue of Liberty notwithstanding. Here to offer an historian's perspective on this historical parallel is Edward O'Donnell, professor of history at Hunter College of the City University of New York.
In recent months, a group calling itself Project USA has caused quite a stir in California, Minnesota, the Carolinas, and many other states by putting up anti-immigrant billboard advertisements. A similar effort in New York City in August made national headlines. What's significant about the controversy is not Project USA's message of immigration restriction. That's hardly a new idea. What's important is the skillful way in which it has presented this message as reformist rather than reactionary. The practice of opposing immigration in the name of reform goes back centuries and relies on two time-tested formulas, both of which are apparent in the Project USA campaign. First, opponents make a mythological distinction between present-day immigration and the flood of newcomers who came in the past. Project USA's website is emphatic on this point. Making this distinction is essential, since most Americans can point to an immigrant ancestor. They argue that past immigration was good for the United States because the immigrants were different. That is, they were European. These immigrants, they argue, were willing to Americanize, as if they had much choice. And, of course, they were too proud to accept welfare, which didn't exist. Second, while there's never been a shortage of people willing to condemn immigration in nakedly racist terms, the most effective anti-immigration groups have always dressed up their bigotry in the respectable clothes of high-minded concern for the common good. To cite but a few examples, in the 1840s, nativists cast their attacks on Irish Catholics as civic duty. Loyalty to the Pope in Rome, they argued, rendered those immigrants incapable of exercising the duties of republican citizenship. At the turn of the century, many justified opposition to immigration by invoking the alleged science of eugenics. Maintaining the nation's health, identity, and values, they insisted, depended on the exclusion of the genetically inferior peoples of Europe and Asia. The billboard campaign sponsored by Project USA is simply the latest version of this tradition. Their billboards bear messages such as, quote, over 80% of Americans support very little immigration or no more immigration. Is anyone listening to us? Unquote. In that way, the group carefully avoids the appearance of opposing immigration on the basis of race or culture. Instead, it cloaks its narrow-minded bigotry in allegedly high-minded concerns over population growth, environmental damage, or urban sprawl. Craig Nelson, the group's founder, goes to great lengths to convince his critics that, quote, it's not about skin color, it's about numbers, unquote. Such assurances ring with the same degree of sincerity as, it's not the money, it's the principle. In interviews, Nelson has let slip his view that America has, quote, enough diversity, unquote. Project USA claims that its billboard campaign is intended to force a national debate on immigration policy. It is a serious issue, one that demands careful consideration of all options, including reducing the annual total of new arrivals. Debate, however, must be open and honest if it is to lead to consensus. Project USA lacks the courage and the honesty to state its real reasons for opposing immigration. Hiding behind convenient myths and smokescreen issues, the organization is clearly not interested in stimulating a debate on immigration. It merely wants to poison it.
You've been listening to Edward O'Donnell, professor of history at Hunter College. Professor O'Donnell's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. For our site of the week, we continue on the subject of Professor O'Donnell's op-ed, American Immigrants, and recommend to you a museum where you can learn more about where immigrants to the United States lived a century ago. Here to tell you about that museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
You get a sense of the living conditions of the 19th century immigrants, but thankfully without the smell. The Tenement Museum in New York brings to life the struggles of the immigrants, The museum is located in Manhattan's Lower East Side, not far from the Bowery. It is housed in one of the more than 10,000 tenement buildings that were closed in 1935 because landlords would not meet new public health regulations. Before number 97 closed, it housed more than 7,000 immigrants of many nationalities between 1864 and 1935. The building was purchased in 1988 and turned into a museum with private funding. Several of the apartments are done up to match living conditions of different time periods and immigrants. The narrow five-story building containing 20 apartments was designated an historic site by the National Trust for Historical Preservation.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced the opening of a new exhibit at its DeSoto National Wildlife Refuge in Missouri Valley, Iowa. The exhibition celebrates the steamboat Bertram. Built in 1864, the flat-hulled sternwheeler was designed for the shallow, narrow rivers of the West. Nevertheless, the Bertram sank on her first trip up the Missouri River in 1865 and was not excavated until 1968. Remains of the ship and much of its cargo will be on display at the DeSoto National Wildlife Refuge Visitors Center until April 30th. For further information, call the DeSoto Refuge in Missouri Valley, Iowa. The History Channel will premiere a show on one of the worst fogs in history. The Killer Fog will air on April 15th, telling the story of a fog that blanketed London for 3 days in early December 1952, leading to the death or injury of at least 4,000 people. And the next night, the History Channel will air a documentary on spy planes, those aircraft that have soared above our enemies for decades, examining their military installations and troop movements. Spy Planes airs on April 16th on the History Channel. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we'll take a look at the history of golf. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. I'm going to go to the next one.